Hello and welcome to Made in Science, the official podcast of the University of Stuttgart. Today's guest, Amrei Bar, is Junior Professor of Philosophy and Technology and Information at the University of Stuttgart. She has been in this position since April 2022, with prior experience as Research Fellow at Heinrich Heine University, Düsseldorf, and the Center for Interdisciplinary Research in Bielefeld. Her academic background includes PhD in philosophy and bachelor's degree in philosophy and Protestant theology from the Westfälische Wilhelms-Universität Münster. And she's also a co-initiator of the hashtag Ich bin Anna campaign. Professor Bar, welcome to Made in Science. I would like to talk with you about different kinds of ethics today, the potential influence of science communication, and the situation of young researchers at academic institutions in Germany. Now, for a start, ethics is your research topic, and we'll go deeper into that. I was wondering if you have a personal definition of ethics that perhaps got you going in your research addressing that topic at all.
Yeah, well, it seems that I always get back to those topics, and the kind of ethics that I'm doing is applied ethics. So I'm thinking about very particular cases. So not general questions so much, but rather questions about, for instance, copying or what we should do with all the waste that we are producing and so on. And this kind of applied ethics to me is something that might seem as something that you can do by applying very abstract principles. So there are those ethical principles that you can discuss, for instance, the idea that something you do should benefit the greatest number of people or something like that. And that's a very abstract principle. And if you think about applied ethics, then you could come up with the idea, so we will just apply this principle to our special case that we want to deal with. And I think that's not the greatest thing to do, because you always have this gap between the very abstract principle and your case that you want to deal with. So therefore, what I find more helpful there is to have principles that are like mid-range principles that are more specialized for what you want to talk about. The price that you pay for that is that you have to limit the range of topics that you can deal with. For instance, you can do an ethics of copying, but then you cannot say something with those principles that you have there about how to deal with waste. You need a different ethics there. So you have a different area of research that you address. So you have principles for each of those areas. And an open question is how to have those areas, how to define them, because that's not trivial, I think. But I think that's the thing that is mostly of interest for me, to figure out what those not so abstract principles could be for special areas of application, for instance, copying or dealing with waste.
We'll go into the various types of ethics that you have mentioned also in our conversation. When you talked, I was just wondering, we live in times of big shifts, transitions and disruption. And I wonder if these times are particularly suited to actually address these ethical questions one by one in the different areas, since oftentimes there seems to be a split in the discussion. We focus on this and then we focus on something else and the next one as well, rather than, as you also said, seeing the whole thing together. So since you are exactly doing this, since you are, I call it splitting up, addressing the various aspects of ethics or fields of ethics, is this a good time for you in your research, in the research interest, and the feedback also?
Yeah, in a way, it's a good time to do this kind of research because there are so many things that go wrong. So in general, it's not a good time, but I think we can see that it's obvious that we need ethical expertise to deal with certain problems. And also, I think it's important what you just indicated, that those areas, they might influence each other. So it's despite the fact that you have principles guiding you in each area individually, there might still be a reason to think of why it's, for instance, reasonable to compensate people from the global south for disadvantages that they have. This might be a general thing that doesn't just apply, for instance, for the question as to how we should deal with waste. It might also, for instance, apply to the question how we deal with copying and related questions. So I have in a paper some time ago discussed the question of Sci-Hub. So the publication system has a problem as long as it's not all open access, because people from countries where there is not enough money to pay those very expensive subscriptions to journals, they might not have access to certain papers. And therefore, one could ask whether it's justified for them to use something like Sci-Hub to get access to those things, because otherwise they will not be able to participate in the whole academic discourse. And I think that's something that applies to several areas of applied ethics. And apart from that, I think it's interesting that in discussions, not in academia, but in discussions we have in society, people tend to say, oh, yeah, that's a moral reason to do something or to not do something. And well, we don't want to talk about those moral issues. And I think we definitely should, especially in those times. So the idea that we just need to come up with pragmatic reasons to do something or to not do something, or that it's all just about the law, I think that doesn't really work. Because, I mean, we can see that the law is something that you can change also, I mean, for the better, but also for the worse, right? And the question how to criticize things like that, if things go wrong also in politics, I mean, we have to worry about that these days a lot. And there it's good to have a moral point of view and to say, okay, what is happening here now is just plain unjust, an unjust thing that is happening. And I can criticize that from my point of view because I have this moral point of view. And if I just say it's just about the law, then if the law is changed in a bad way, who is going to criticize this? On what grounds, actually?
Now, you talked already about one of those topics of ethics, and that would be publishing, especially in academia. You mentioned the Global South in that regard as well. Let's perhaps explore a little bit on that one. What about the situation here at home in Germany? Publishing comes with a price tag these days for those who want to publish. How do you think about that? And what has your research perhaps concluded so far? Has this led to an increase, to a decrease? Is it stable when it comes to the number of publications? What are some of the effects of this particular situation here in Germany?
Yeah, I think what we need to take a look at is how the publication system is changing right now. So we have this shift to open access. The system that we had before worked basically like this. Somebody writes a paper. Normally, that's a person who is a researcher. They have a job at a university or a research institution. They will write a paper and they will give this for free to the publisher. And then the publisher will take it. There will be some sort of peer review, maybe some quality check. And then that will also happen for free, mostly. And then the publisher will take the paper and say, okay, so I will now ask the universities, the research institutions, to pay money to get access to that paper by a subscription or something like that. That was the system that was criticized for obvious reasons. I mean, we gave our work for free to the publisher, and then the publisher said, okay, and in addition, I also want money from the research institutions and from the universities to get access to that research, because otherwise nobody will keep on working with the insights that are in the paper. And now we have this shift to open access, which is a good thing, at least in so far as the access to those papers is not tied to having such a subscription. So you don't need to be a researcher at some institution with a subscription that gives you access to those particular things. But the way that we change the system to an open access system now doesn't really work out in the end as well, because now you don't have to pay to get access to the publication, but you pay to publish. So if I want to publish a paper, I have to pay the publisher to do that. So I have this article processing charge that I have to pay. And if I don't have the money to do that, then I cannot publish my research. And then also I cannot participate in what is being done in my discipline. And I mean, that's a problem, obviously, I think for also, again, for those who are living in countries where there is not enough money for that kind of thing. So you don't have the money to pay for your paper, but also early career researchers in Germany, or depending on the discipline that you are working on, even professors in Germany, they might not have the money that they need to publish a paper, because I mean, it's also quite expensive. And we do that even though we don't have to do it, because we could do it differently. We could have our scholarly-led publishing system where we do all the work that we do anyway, because again, we do the work. So we do the work to write the paper, we do the work for the peer review system and so on. And we mostly do it for free. And we could keep on doing that. The only difference would be that there is no publisher involved. And now you could ask, why are there still publishers involved? And I think the reason is that our whole reputation system rests on those publishers. So if you get an application from a person for a professor position, then you check their publication list, and then you will check whether the person has publications in a fancy journal, in a fancy journal with a publisher that has some reputation. And that will be an indicator that the person is interesting for the job. And if they don't have that, they might write very, very good papers. But if they have been published in a journal that nobody really knows, that is not famous, that does not have that kind of reputation, also, because there are so many applications for such positions that you are like, you have hundreds of pages of applications, so not everything will be read. And therefore, I think the whole system rests on the reputation by those publishers. Also, there is no need to do that. We could also change that. We need to make more changes there, because we would need to increase the chances to get a job in academia in order to do that, so that you don't have like 120 applications for a professor position. But all those things are worth discussing, I think, because otherwise we will spend a whole lot of money for this whole publication system, be it the old system where we spend our working hours as well as the money to get access to the publications, but also the new system with open access where you have to pay to publish. And we need the money elsewhere. So the system is there is not enough money in there anyway, even in countries that have rather good systems in academia and that have enough money. There is some sort of not a good way of allocating that money if you put it into the publication system like that. So I think as a community, we can change that. We have the power to change that, but we have to do it. And we should not just sit there and say, oh, yeah, then now there's the open access movement and it's not going great, but we'll just leave it like it is. But we should really change the whole thing by thinking about ways to have more autonomy again as researchers in the whole publication system.
Thank you very much. A situation very well addressed and also clearly described in this, for Germany and beyond, as we just heard. Talking about beyond, another area in your studies of ethics that has already come up in your conversation with us earlier is recycling. And I do know that you went also or did research on Ghana in this particular area. And I wonder what your main take away from that one is? What did you find there, and how? What conclusions did you come up with? I do recall at this moment the very, very first podcast made in science with a colleague from Mexico. And she gave a great example how her studies here at the university led her to specific recycling initiative, actually at the company she was working at. So those interested in that particular topic, I do recommend to listen to the very, very first Made in Science topic. But back to you and your current experiences.
Yeah, so recycling is a thing that, especially in Germany, seems to be something that everybody can agree on, that it's a great thing, right? So we recycle, that's a great thing to do with waste, because on the one hand, we get rid of all the waste, and on the other hand, it's not just wasted in the sense that we just put it somewhere or we burn it, but we will make something new out of it, which sounds really, really good. And I think that is one reason why this is so prominent also in public debate, that we should recycle. And you also have this as a way of doing marketing for your product. You can recycle this product, or the product is produced from material that has been recycled and so on. All those things give you the impression it's a great thing to recycle. So it's, if we have the choice between putting all the stuff on some sort of waste dump area and we just don't deal with it anymore, then future generations have to deal with it. So that doesn't sound great. Also, there might be pollution of the area where it's at, so that's also not great. If we burn it, yeah, we also might think, okay, maybe we waste the potential of making something new out of the waste. So let's do recycling. That sounds pretty great. From an ethical perspective also, because I mean, the thing that we can see is we have lots and lots of waste and it's getting more and more, and we have this overconsumption and also an overproduction of waste that is linked to that. So we have to figure out what to do with all that stuff. But the thing is that if you recycle things, that does not automatically lead to a morally great way of dealing with waste, because as you mentioned, there might be examples where recycling is happening, but it's happening at a high price. And not for us, I mean, the example of Ghana, or there are also other examples, those are interesting because we send our waste to other countries and then other people there will deal with the waste. And for instance, with e-waste recycling, that will be shipped to Ghana and then there will be people standing there and burning your toaster or whatever the device that you sent there to get to the metal that is in there that is valuable. And they will do that in surroundings that are very toxic. The whole working conditions, they are all very toxic. They will harm the people who work there. They will harm the people who live there. And they will also harm the local environment. And then you can say, okay, there has been recycling in the sense that what we have put into the waste bin has been used to create something new. So yeah, that's as if that's your term of recycling, which is also a thing that you can discuss, of course, what is a reasonable term of recycling, then that is recycling, but it's something that harms people who then have to deal with our waste. And it's for the global north, that is something that's cheap and they will be happy to just send their waste somewhere else and have other people deal with it. So I think what we need is a more fine-grained discussion of the whole thing. So just saying, if we have the choice, let's do recycling, that will be fine in the end. That's something that I don't find convincing given those examples. I mean, there are also other examples which are interesting to question whether it's even effective to do recycling. Sometimes it might be even reasonable to not do that because there are also other reasons from a pragmatic point of view, maybe, to deal with waste differently. But from the ethical perspective, I would say, so what we need to take into account is not just us here in Germany or in the global north, but we have to figure out how this will affect other people in other countries. And apart from that, of course, also, which is a discussion that we should have much more, the question how it will affect future generations, because they are also in the picture, and they might be confronted with all the waste that we've created. So how can we come up with an idea to create a fair use of that waste, or a fair way of dealing with that waste? And that's more complex than just saying, okay, if we recycle, then we are fine. I think it feels like people will they will just buy themselves out of feeling bad by thinking, okay, if I do the recycling thing, then it's okay. There is this overconsumption problem. I see that. But yeah, the things, they will get recycled. So it's fine in the end, right? There's no, so that's also, I think, a weird way of looking at this circle of recycling, because there's, of course, you don't have like 100% of things that will get reused. But apart from that, so maybe just to add that, of course, the best way would be to have less waste. So to make sure that you don't produce waste in the first place. But even if we manage to produce less waste, we have the problem already, because there is already so much of that stuff in our world that we need to come up with a good solution.
Mm-hmm. Waste, by the way, is also one of our most successful international master programs taught here at the University of Stuttgart, and students from all over the world, literally, are students there, and they keep a great network among themselves. And I think, it is an area that I see at it. Educational fairs that I attend, students are always interested in, or should I say future students, and that's a good sign to sort of readdress issues in the way you described as well, and get more to the point of what it means to recycle. The third topic that I would like to address, and that you do research in, is the philosophy of artifacts when it comes to ethics. I think, from what I understand, it is still quite a new research field. May I ask, what is your main focus in this field? And most
of
all,
that's
what
a very tricky question. And
I have,
so especially the question, what is an artifact, has been in my focus for quite some time. So I might start out with saying that an artifact, the way that I want to take a look at it, is not something that you sometimes talk about if you have mistakes. For instance, if you have pictures in medicine where you have mistakes because something went wrong. So that is sometimes called an artifact as well. But that's an unintended mistake that is happening there because something went wrong. And that's not the kind of artifacts that I'm interested in. So the artifacts that I talk about are, if you take a look around, there will be many items around you. For instance, maybe a chair, a desk, a glass, all those things, a book. And those things, they qualify as artifacts. They are intentionally created by humans. You can discuss whether that needs to be the case. Maybe there are other species capable of creating artifacts. But the important thing is those things are intentionally created. And you have decided about certain properties of those things. I think it's obvious that you don't need to decide on every property. For instance, if you build a chair out of wood, then the wood will look a certain way and you might not be able to change anything about that. But you can decide how the chair or the table or whatever you want to build with it, how that will look like. So you will be able to decide, at least for some properties, how they should be. And that's something that is important, because you might also make this decision by leaving things as they are. For instance, if you take a look at art, I think it's always interesting to take a look at art. I am a philosopher of art also, even though I don't have that that much in my focus right now. But there you see, for instance, Herman de Vries is an artist who walks into the woods and takes a tree trunk and carries it over to a museum without changing anything about it. So it will not be painted. It will not be modified in any other way. And the interesting question there is that already an artifact, even though there was nothing changed about the object? And I would say yes, because you could have changed something about it. And that's also the interesting answer. If you, for instance, want to figure out why it's not possible that I turn the moon into my artifact, or the Alps, or something like that, because there you would say, okay, I cannot appropriate those things myself. An act of appropriation wouldn't really make much sense, as it does with some tiny items that I find in the woods. And that's why, so the reason for that, I think, that you cannot turn the moon into your artifact is that you are not able to change something, even if you want to. So saying, I will leave the properties of the moon like they are, and now it will be my artifact, that doesn't work because I could not have changed the properties in a different manner. And that's, so artifacts, I think, are the basic term of everyday objects, art objects, and so on, even abstract objects. For instance, if you think about works of art, musical works, what is a musical work or work of literature? That's an abstract object, I'd say. There is a huge discussion in philosophy whether there is such a thing as an abstract object and whether there is such a thing as an abstract object that you as an artist can create. People are not that sure about that, but I think it's possible. So you have this great realm of very different items that form our culture, basically, and that you can also copy. And that is something that I have been very interested in, copying those things and what is happening there.
Thank you. This goes much deeper than I thought, I must admit. As we all already can agree on at this moment, you are excellent in communicating your topics. We hear it today in the podcast, but we also know that you were awarded a number of prizes for your science communication. You were awarded a prize for participation in the Denkste Project. You have also been given the Communicator Award. I think it was in 2022. Correct me if I'm wrong. Which is the science award of the Donors Association, Stifterverband, for innovative and future-oriented science communication, announced by the German Research Foundation, the DFG. Now, with prizes, I wonder, in how far do they support communication about science topic after they have been awarded? Is it like leading up to that one moment and the big applause, well-deserved? Or how can you go on operating with the background of these prizes? And I think I don't mention financially necessarily, but perhaps as well.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing. I mean, it's absolutely great to have such a prize and to receive it. It's an honor. It's a great feedback. So it's absolutely fabulous to have those prizes and important. But equally important, I'd say, is to have some sort of basic funding for those things, because we see that there are many people who, for very good reasons, say, academics need to communicate, so we need science communication. That's a very important thing these days. We need evidence-based politics, especially in times where populists are very loud, and we need to have science in order to indicate why what they say might be wrong, might be false, and therefore it's very important for scientists to go out there and communicate. And I would always say that is true. But of course, you need resources. You need time, for instance. If you write a paper for a journal, which is your job as a researcher, a part of your job, actually, or if you do your teaching or something like that, then you cannot at the same time do a radio interview or write an article for a newspaper or something like that. So first, you need time. And also what you need, secondly, is to have somebody tell you how this works, I think, because there are very great researchers who might not want or be able to communicate their research in a way that people outside their research area might easily understand what it's about. And that also, I have to add that depending on what you do your research on, it might be much more difficult to communicate it than with other topics. I mean, I can easily talk about recycling. Everybody will know why this might be important because it's part of their everyday life. But there are complex issues that you can do your research on where it's not that easy to even explain to people why you are interested in the particular topic that you're working on. And also money is an issue, I think, because I mean, you have to come up with formats, for instance, where you can reach people. So, I mean, you can, of course, do lots and lots of things on social media, but that has worked not that well. I have been very happy to hear that the University of Stuttgart has decided to leave former Twitter, now X, because I think that's a platform where we should not be as academics and academic institutions anymore, because it has turned into a platform that is used to have fake news and everything else in focus. And that's something that's not great. And if the algorithms work against you as a researcher or a research institution, then you have no chance to win. So that's a good thing. But there is not just social media. There's not just this internet thing, right? There is also we want to talk to people. We want to maybe have them, we will want to invite them to the university. We will maybe invite colleagues of ours that we think have important topics, or we will want to do a citizen science project where citizens are involved. I think that's a great thing to also have expertise from citizens. And therefore, I think what we need is just as with science in general, be it research, teaching, or science communication, we need core funding that will give us the opportunity to do all those things. Because if you just do it with grants and prizes and say, okay, there are few people that we will give the money to now, then you also have a lot of time that, especially with grants, goes into the whole process of getting the money. So if you need to write an application first, and maybe even two applications, and you need to do lots and lots of work, and there are people who will review what you've written, then that will be time that is not there for research and teaching, but also not for science communication. So especially with regard to the fact that we need science as a voice in society now more than ever, because the political situation is so tense that we really, really need scientists to be part of the discussions on public debates and so on. We really need to make sure that people can afford that they have the time and the resources to do that.
Talking about people, a few years ago, you started the campaign hashtag Ich bin Hanna with fellow researchers Christine Eichhorn and Sebastian Kubon to protest against precarious working conditions in academia. You also criticized the academic fixed-term contract, Wissenschaftszeitvertragsgesetz, arguing that it undermines quality and diversity in higher education. Two questions from that one. What are some of your experiences from these two initiatives? And what are your future goals for the campaigns?
Yeah, so the experience is that it's really great to work together as a community with lots and lots of solidarity and to have this choir of voices who will raise their voices for a better system, for better working conditions. Because the law that you've mentioned with the horrible name Wissenschaftszeitvertragsgesetz, this is responsible for people in early career phases of their academic career that they have those fixed term contracts, and often very many of them. So before your PhD, you can be 6 years on those contracts, and afterwards you can be another 6 years on fixed term contracts. But the problem is that it's not, you don't get like a 6 year contract regularly, but the contracts are much shorter. So you will not be able in most of the time to finish your PhD or your postdoc project with one contract, but you need more than one. And that causes many problems. For instance, people will wonder whether they can pay their rent in half a year or so. And I think that also makes the academic system not very attractive to potential new researchers. And it's unfair, as you've mentioned, the topic of diversity is very important there. Because, for instance, if you can only stay in this country if you have a contract, then not having a contract is not only bad for you because you don't have the money to pay your rent, but you also might need to leave the country. And that makes it much harder to enter such a situation if you are also dependent on having a contract for being able to stay here. So therefore, we've criticized that, and I think we've come a long way. So the thing is that the current German government, or the former German government who wanted to change the law, they did not finish that before they collapsed. So now we will have to wait for the new German government, what they will do, hopefully something good about it, because I think given that we need researchers and that it's already difficult to find people who want to do that under those conditions, we need to change the conditions for the better. And so therefore, I can always say it's good to raise your voice, and it's good to do that with other people, because then it's that you're not exposed as a single person, but there are other people who will work towards a better future with you. And that helps a lot, I think, in order to change something about the system.
Towards the end of our conversation, I want to look back and I want to look ahead with you. Looking back, we now know that you are engaged in various topics of very high relevance today at universities, but also beyond. I wonder, how did you discover your affinity for philosophy and ethics? When was the moment that you said, that's exactly what I would like to work on and help to redefine, to reshape, adjust where necessary? Do you remember that particular moment? Was there such a moment, or was it gradual, or whatever?
Yeah, well, I mean, after I finished school, I first started to study law, but I didn't finish the first semester even. And then I thought about doing something else, like graphic design or something like that. I always wanted to be a journalist, actually. That was an idea that I had in mind. Yeah, but after the graphic design thing also didn't work out, I thought, okay, now I will choose something that something reasonable. I will choose philosophy, and I entered that. And the thing that really fascinates me about philosophy is that it helps you to create some sort of structure in our chaotic everyday life. So you can figure out, for instance, how arguments work and how they don't work. If you listen to discussions in the media, a talk show or something like that, and you think, oh, something is wrong with this particular argument that the person just presented, then philosophy gives you methods to figure out why this argument is flawed. And you can indicate, okay, there is like a false premise in there or something like that. And I think that's very helpful to structure things, to also think about concepts, conceptual analysis, to so then get a deeper understanding of phenomena that we deal with every day, but we are not that sure what is a person, for instance, or what makes a copy, and all those things. I think that's something that will never stop fascinating me. If I do it as a job or not in the future is something that that we'll see, but something that is, I think, a huge potential for philosophy, because it helps us to bring structure into certain debates, and also gives us hints maybe to how to solve problems that we discuss also as a society.
You just mentioned the word future, and I'm taking you up on that. So looking ahead, where do you see your interest is perhaps not the good word here, but your future career, then your next step rather, that would be it. Where do you see your next step in academia or outside of academia? Do you have any ideas about that already?
Yeah, it's not a secret that I'm a junior professor without a tenure track at the University of Stuttgart, unfortunately. Otherwise, I would say I'd love to be here. I'd love to stay here. Yeah, so there is not that option. And I would say if academia offers me a job that I find attractive enough to stay, then I will most probably do that. But I think there are also other fascinating areas. For instance, politics is interesting. So science politics is something that I deeply care about. And I think the main thing that I want to do is I want to work towards making a change of things for the better. So that's something that I'm interested in, be it as an academic or be it as somebody who works in a different area. But I think that's something that would be the requirement for a future job that would be something that is not something that I would want to discuss, but that at least needs to be the case. And then I think something great will turn up.
Before you do that, we will certainly take you up on our part that is called Moment 7. We have collected 7 questions that we would like you to ask. Please answer them as shortly as possible. Moment 1. Spätzle or Maultaschen?
Spätzle.
Moment 2. One thing that you could change about the world would be?
More justice for everyone.
Moment 3. Do you have a recommendation for arts for us? It could be a book, a movie, theater, music.
Music is always good, but I don't have a particular song or something that I can say listen to. But yeah, I think music is the thing that is most important to me.
Moment 4. The best advice that you have ever received was?
To not think about failing so much, but to think about succeeding, being in love with succeeding, ins Gelingen verliebt sein, nicht ins Scheitern. That's the German quote from Bloch. And I think that's an important thing. Yeah.
Moment 5. Your favorite place here at the University of Stuttgart is which one?
I think it's on campus here in the city, because I always love, especially in the summer, that people are hanging out there and having a great time. I always love to see that they are doing sports, they are just sitting there talking, and they are just enjoying themselves. And I love that about the campus.
Moment 6. If I could start all over again, I would do the following differently.
I think I would do things just the same, but I would be aware that the probability to stay in academia is very small, and I would maybe give more time to having time with your family and so on, because I have not done that for quite some time, for a long time, and I know that that has not increased my chances a lot. So I would advise people, you have just this one life, and spend it with the people you love. Also, if you are a researcher, that doesn't make you a worse researcher. Quite on the contrary, having a life apart from your work is something that you should do, and it's a good thing, and you are still a great researcher. You don't have to put everything in your work first and everything else second. I think that's the thing that I've learned in the years that I've done that job.
And finally, moment 7. Please complete the sentence. Thanks to my studies, I know that.
Good arguments count, be it in academia or in politics or in society. They count because they can change something, they can convince people, and that's a huge power of good arguments that should make us optimistic also with regards to how things will develop in this world.
Professor Bahr, thank you so much for our conversation about made in science, what is made in science, how you think about science, what should change for those. who work in science and beyond all of that. Most of all, wishing you a very, very good results with your current work and also in the future.
Thank you so much. That has been a pleasure.
And to our audience, please stay tuned for our next conversations that are always based on what is made in science. My name is Wolfgang Holtkamp. Have a great podcast day. Goodbye and good talking.